Welcome to WISO Weekend, our weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us. We've got a lot coming your way in the next half hour. First, with the threat of a teacher strike looming, parents of Dayton Public Schools students gathered last Tuesday to come up with a plan B. DPS district officials say school will start as scheduled on August 15th, but many parents are still worried about how a strike could affect their children. WISO's April Leslie reports.
First of all, there's a lot of information that we don't know, and that's why we're here tonight.
In a small meeting room at Grace United Methodist Church in Dayton, about three dozen parents have come to hear the latest about the possible teacher strike at Dayton Public Schools. Many parents are weighing their options. They're trying to decide whether to keep their kids home if their teachers do walk off the job. DPS parent and school board candidate Jocelyn Reinard.
Above all, I want to make sure that we are united as a group. Parents in this room and outside this room will make different decisions about their kids, what they're going to do with their kids regarding the strike. Some parents have the freedom to make choices for their kids, and some parents don't.
The teachers' union filed a 10-day strike notice on Monday, meaning if a deal isn't reached, teachers could strike as early as August 11th. That's 4 days before school starts. DPS is assuring parents school will go on, strike or no strike. Officials say they will rely on district subs and employ a staffing company to fill the gaps. Linda Huggins is the parent of three DPS students. She's also a teacher in the district and will picket with her union if contract talks break down. She'll be keeping her kids home from school during the strike. She's afraid the school environment will be too chaotic.
It's going to be, in my opinion, too much. Kids will be kids, and you leave them to their own devices with a sub, who knows what they'll be in there doing.
Parent Michelle Hangen is leaving the choice up to her daughter, a senior in high school. She says her daughter is concerned about losing the teachers she already knows well. She's uncertain if the substitutes will be able to create the right learning environment.
And I do think putting in strangers, they may be really good people, but they don't have that rapport already established with her and with her peers. And I think there's some potential for disrupted learning to happen.
Back at the meeting, some parents are concerned because they remember the last DPS teacher strike. It happened in 1993 and lasted 16 days.
My parents sent me to school, we got there, and we learned nothing.
Many parents are worried about how the turmoil in the district will affect the community's image of Dayton as a whole, which they say has already been damaged by district mismanagement and teacher turnover. Over 100 people resigned from DPS this year alone.
We know that our school system is the center of our community. People choose to live in different places because of their school system. That's one of the first things they look for. Who wants to move somewhere and have to pay for their kids to be educated because they can't retain highly qualified teachers?
If the schools aren't there, no young couples are going to come in and they're going to be like, oh, I'm pregnant, I'm moving out, I'm moving to the suburbs, I'll just commute.
The teachers' union and DPS officials have three more chances to avoid a strike. Their first negotiation session is Thursday. For WYSO, I'm April Leslie.
A deadly ride malfunction at the Ohio State Fair last week has raised questions about ride oversight and inspections. From public radio station WOSU, Esther Honig has been looking around and found regulations for rides vary widely from state to state.
A week after the fatal accident at the ride, the Fireball, many fairgoers aren't deterred.
I'm here to ride all of the rides, the ones that are open, of course.
Dylan Bryant is standing in line for tickets and doesn't think an accident like that will happen again.
Yeah, it's kind of scary, the fact that, you know, somebody died. But, I mean, honestly, if they were still all open, I'd ride them all still.
In Ohio, state inspectors assess the rides before they can be licensed to operate. That's in addition to the inspectors hired by the ride owners. Some rides even require the expertise of a third-party inspector. It's a thorough process, but some states have far fewer regulations.
First of all, it depends on what state you're in.
Ken Martin has specialized in amusement ride inspection and safety since the 90s. Rides like the Fireball are constantly being disassembled, loaded onto trucks, and driven to fairs across the country. And each state has different rules on how that machine is inspected and different safety standards. For example, in Ohio, as in many states, the ride owners are responsible for reporting any accidents or malfunctions.
And I've said before, and I'll say it again, and sometimes it's a case of the fox guarding the hen house.
And when a malfunction or design flaw causes an accident, Martin says unless it garners media attention, it can take weeks before other inspectors find out and know what to look for.
Well, I am very concerned about the serious injuries and deaths, but I'm also concerned greatly about the near misses.
He says some kind of federal oversight would help. When it comes to informing consumers, there is no national database that tracks every injury resulting from an amusement ride. Research by Nationwide Children's Hospital estimates there are more than 4,000 kids injured on rides each year. But Tracy Meehan with Nationwide told WOSU better data is needed to understand the scope of the problem.
Because what that will allow us to do is track, is an injury happening on a certain kind of ride? Or is it more fixed sites versus mobile? We really don't have a clear picture right now, so it's really hard to tell.
Meehan thinks a federal database would be the best solution, but that's something that many in the mobile ride industry have strongly opposed for years.
Hello.
Hi, Bob. This is Esther Honig. How are you? Bob Johnson is president of the Outdoor Amusement Business Association, one of the largest trade groups in this industry. It's been around since the 60s.
We believe that we are better off as an industry with state oversight, with regulations that are designed to protect the public and certainly protect the industry as well.
When it comes to how rides are inspected and how the inspectors are trained, some organizations have become leaders in best practices. Their standards have been adopted by many states, including Ohio, but not every state. Johnson pushes states to follow these standards, but still opposes the notion that they be federally mandated. When accidents happen, he says the state and the industry are perfectly capable of regulating themselves. For example, in 2003, when a young boy at an Ohio fair was fatally electrocuted.
You know, since then, you know, things have changed, both in the state and from a regulatory standpoint, as well as our industry.
At the end of the day, says Johnson, the ride owners are the ones who have the most at stake when something goes wrong. He says it's in their best interest to follow best practices and adhere to manufacturer requirements. For Ohio Public Radio, I'm Esther Honig.
All this summer, WYSO is bringing you stories of Ohioans living with disabilities. Today, we hear from 41-year-old Robert Sabwami. Robert tells us about his experience growing up in Kenya with a visual impairment. Now he's a grad student studying at Wright State University. In this story from WYSO producer April Leslie, he says his journey to get there hasn't always been easy. When Robert first started losing his vision, he was plunged into isolation.
That was the darkest point in my life. You know, every time my mind goes back to that point in time, it's like, fresh emotions are triggered in my heart. No one understood it, not even family. My name is Robert Sabwami, and currently I'm a grad student at Wright State University. For me, I think it was at age 14 that my mom picked up, you know, something going on with my eyes. I remember coming in the house just after playing. I think we were called for lunch. So while at the serving table, I was serving myself stew. I remember it was beef stew. But my eyes were not, you know, focusing at the serving plate. My pupil was, you know, facing one side while I'm doing what I was doing on this other side. So my mom was like, I mean, excuse me, you've just been playing. Can't you be serious for once? Look at what you're doing. And now I know the condition that I have, it's RP, retinitis pigmentosa. You could not pick it up just by looking at my eyes. You know, when you look at my eyeballs, they looked okay. I would show no signs of a visual impairment. I think they would just attribute all my poor performance to playfulness. And that's what they really hammered me on. They always said, you're too playful for once, just get serious and pay attention to your studies. Not knowing that this thing was actually creeping in and... I remember during my high school years, we had what you call night prep classes. We had to study after dinner. We had like 3-4 hours of study before going to bed. So I could no longer, you know, use my sight to read in the night. So as a kid growing up, you can imagine, you know, your peers are studying and they're succeeding in their studies. They're, you know, getting good scores and good grades. And my grades were pathetic. Just because of my visual impairment, which was not understood by my parents or my teachers. Unfortunately, I had to drop out of high school because of this condition. I remember my elder brother once lashed out at me, saying that I was going to die poor when I made the decision to quit high school. And it really, you know, it hurt me. It really hurt me to the point where I just decided to go back and crawl back in my own cocoon. And this is the period I refer to as my 10 darkest years, because it was a period of 10 years, from 1995 to 2005. No reading, no writing, just there. My sister also has this condition, and I think her case is worse than mine, because she is next to totally blind. She enrolled in some training institutes where she learned Braille, she learned assistive technology stuff, and she had a rebirth. She was totally new and transformed. When she came back home, she was like, hey guys, this is what I found. And so I did Braille, I did adaptive technology training, orientation and mobility, and from that point my life got totally transformed. Then from there I secured a permanent job that to me was, you know, a big surprise. I never imagined I would get a job, ever. I was just like blown away. And here I am in the U.S. I got a green card that allows me to live and work in the U.S. So I immediately enrolled for high school. I got my high school diploma. From there, I was able to complete my time at St. Clair, transferred all my credits to Wright State University, and here I am. Just graduated from my undergraduate studies with highest honors, you know, getting my summa cum laude. It was like, oh my God, I only got one B in my whole experience in college. Everything else was straight A's. So looking back, you know, my teachers labeled me, you know, unteachable or stupid. You know, sometimes they would just be blatant. You know, they would think I'm so thick, I would not get anything in school. But how can you explain this? How did I get my summa cum laude, highest honors, if I was that stupid?
Robert Subwami is a graduate student at Wright State. He's also been looking for a job. Special thanks to Wright State University's Office of Disability Services. To learn more about our series, visit us at WYSO.org. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WYSO Weekend. U.S. Senator Sherrod Brown was in Springfield on Friday to kick off a program designed to help boys and young men of color get ready for college and careers. The Ohio program is affiliated with a national program called My Brother's Keeper. It was started by the Obama administration as a way to address educational opportunity gaps for young people in underserved communities. Brown has been a champion of the program, launching chapters in Dayton, Toledo, Mansfield, Lorain County, and elsewhere in the state. In this interview, he says the program provides needed mentors to young people who otherwise might not make it to college.
We in Ohio now have more of these My Brother's Keeper initiatives than any other state. There are more than a dozen in Ohio. Where the first one was in Dayton and with Mayor Whaley at our kickoff a couple years ago. And the White House was out here helping us with them. And it's going to be one of his legacies as a former president, President Obama's legacies in it. And it really is a way to help to encourage more mentors and mentor-mentee relationships, particularly with young men of color, whether they're whatever their ethnic background, but to encourage more young men of color to be mentors and be mentees. My role as Ohio's senator is to encourage and kind of help to kick them off. Meeting, and today in Springfield, I met with a number of young men, all in high school from freshmen to seniors, one young man just out of high school, and a handful of their mentors and other people in the community that are working together to establish more mentor relationships with young men, starting oftentimes in the seventh or eighth grade.
And since its inception, is there any way to quantify the benefits that have occurred as a result of this program?
I think when you listen to a young man, 16, 17 years old, and describe how this has given him direction, given him more of a understanding of options in their lives, you can see why My Brother's Keeper works for in community after community. There are never enough mentors. There are never enough people that are willing to do that. But every mentor-mentee relationship you can help to start has the potential to change lives.
You mentioned Dayton Mayor Nan Whaley, and a lot of her platform has surrounded education and education goals, and this program works in well with that.
Yeah, my brother's keeper works with public school groups, works with groups like Big Brother, Big Sister, works with the SOIC in Springfield. It works with all kinds of local organizations, sometimes based in the school, sometimes not. Generally, money raised privately, not public dollars. There's no major My Brother's Keeper funding coming out of Washington, nothing like that. It really is locally grown, locally controlled. My role is just to kind of help them learn and help move in that direction and give them some impetus that way.
Senator Sherrod Brown, we appreciate your time today.
Sure. Glad to do it. Thanks, Jerry.
For 5 years now, the Dayton chapter of A Special Wish Foundation has held the Glow for Wishes golf tournament. The foundation says it's the only night of the year when you can hit the links after the sun sets. All of the funds raised in this charity event will help A Special Wish Foundation fulfill their mission to provide wishes to local children who are battling life-threatening disorders. The event takes place Friday, August 25th at Community Golf Club in Dayton. And to get the details, we spoke with the foundation's executive director and WISO Resource Board member David Sire. He begins this interview by describing some of the wishes that have been granted to the children and families they serve.
Wishes can range from anything that a child can dream of. And so we want to just make sure that a child that is battling against a challenging illness can find some sunshine in the middle of this tornado that they're in.
And give me an example of some of the children that you've helped recently.
Well, majority of our kids go to Walt Disney World. It is the happiest place on earth. And when you have spent a lot of time in the hospital, happiness is what you want. And so it's a great opportunity for our families to reconnect, to be families again. Because when a child's in a hospital, when a child's battling cancer or another illness, you know, the focus is on getting the child better. So siblings kind of are ignored or they don't get as much quality time with their parents. And so this wish really brings the entire family back together. And outside of Disney, they want to meet their favorite sports teams. We've had wishes meet the Green Bay Packers, the Pittsburgh Steelers. Had a young boy who wanted to go-kart race Dale Earnhardt Jr. And so we've had wishes across the board from parties to celebrate the removal of a port to getting in a go-kart and racing Dale Earnhardt Jr.
And so he came through on that wish.
Oh, he was awesome. It took less than an hour to make that wish happen. It was one phone call. His assistant called us right back and said, absolutely, when can we do this? Which is pretty common with most folks. We rarely get a celebrity or someone that tells us, no, I don't want to grant a sick child's wish.
And so how many families and children do you serve?
We grant approximately 50 wishes a year. And when we grant a wish, not only do we send the child, but we send the child and everyone who lives with that child. And so we, on an average, 500 to 600 people a year are part of our programming.
And how do you pull all this together? Let's talk a little bit about your organization and staffing and volunteers here.
We are a very streamlined staff. There's three of us total, but we're dedicated. We're dedicated to our mission, and we're honored to do what we do. These families have been through so much. These children have been through so much. And so for us to grant their wish, it's a mission of love that we do. And we want to make sure that they have these opportunities because we don't know the outcome. And unfortunately, for families whose child may not survive their diagnosis, their wish trip is their memories. It's their memories of hearing their child laugh, seeing them run, having fun. And so that's really what we want to be part of, that experience for the families. And we have a very big volunteer team. We rely heavily on volunteers to help with our special events, to help with our deliveries to the hospital. And so it's a great streamlined organization, but we have a lot of very passionate people who are dedicated to what we do.
And I imagine volunteers are going to be helping you with an upcoming event. You've got a golf tournament coming up?
Yes, August 25th. It is our Glow for Wishes nighttime golf tournament. It is one of a kind, unique, great night of golf. If you've never played Glow Golf before, it's something. It's just a lot of fun. We play out at a community golf club here in Dayton, and we tee off at 8:30. So we give you the first hole at dusk, so you can kind of get a grasp of what it's going to look like. And then by the time you tee off for the second hole, it is all neon. Your golf ball is an LED golf ball that lights up when you hit it. The course is lit by neon and other LED lights, and hopefully a full moon that night. And then you play 9 holes, and it's really fun. One of my favorite parts of the event is we're back at the clubhouse preparing things, getting ready for the end of the event, and you can hear people laughing across the golf course. So it's not a serious game of golf, but it's a lot of fun, and especially for folks who are like, well, I don't know if I want to play at night. I'm a serious golfer, and they end up coming and just having a blast because you don't know where the sand traps are, and you don't find some of these challenges out there until you're upon them. So it's really fun, and it is a 4-person best ball scramble, so you don't even have to be good. You just got to come out and have a good time.
And bring someone who's good.
Absolutely. If you have one person who's good, you always play their ball and everybody's ready to roll.
Well, great. Where can folks find out more information about the tournament or if they want to volunteer for your organization?
Log on to aspecialwishdayton.org, or you can always call us at 937-223-WISH.
What else is on the horizon for you?
Well, on September 14th, for all of you that have been to Basil's on the Market in downtown Dayton or have thought about going, Basil's is hosting a one-of-a-kind fundraiser for us. It's a night. It's called The Wonderful World of Basil's, and they're bringing out their premier signature dishes as well as a few very special dishes for that night. And all proceeds from that event will go to grant little Chloe's wish to go to Walt Disney World and be a princess. And that does include all your food as well as beer and wine. To find out more information about the Wonderful World of Basil's, also log on to A Special Wish Foundation Dayton and click on the events button, and all that information will be there on how you can be part of that fun night as well.
All right. And all of this, of course, is aimed at granting wishes to children who are dealing with terminal illnesses. David Sayer with A Special Wish Foundation Dayton Chapter. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Today on Why So Curious, we answer a question from listener Eileen Ribbler of Kettering about a statue of a little boy and a dog at Woodland Cemetery in Dayton. Eileen wanted to know what was the story behind the marker, one of the most iconic monuments in the cemetery, which commemorates 5-year-old Johnny Morehouse. Community Voices producer Renee Wild went to this famous Dayton landmark to dig up the answer.
Johnny was the son of a local cobbler who fell into an old canal that cut through the center of Dayton, where Patterson Boulevard now runs. His beloved dog pulled him from the water, but unfortunately, Johnny had drowned. The local legend has it that Johnny's dog stayed by the gravesite after he was buried. And carved on the marker are items that were on the young boy when he drowned, which includes a harmonica, a top, a small ball, and his cap. It's one of the most popular monuments in the cemetery, and one that draws people to interact. Visitors leave offerings of flowers and small trinkets on Johnny's marker, like hand-woven bracelets, small toys, and photos. The cemetery staff clears off the items regularly to preserve the monument. So every morning, the boy and his dog start the day off fresh, ready to engage with a new group of visitors.
Oh, did you guys hear that?
Woodland Cemetery is also an arboretum, with over 3,000 trees. And hanging out in those majestic oaks, magnolias, and shagbark hickories are birds. Lots and lots of birds.
Well, last spring, during the migration, the birds are really bright and... So at one point there were like 3 scarlet tanagers everywhere you looked. They're really, really bright red. So that was a thrill.
That's Ann Gallagher. She's here this morning for one of the cemetery's themed guided tours, which includes the History, Mystery, Mayhem, and Murder Tour and the Women of Woodland, both of which focus on the many famous residents buried in these rolling hills. But this morning's tour focused on the living residents of Woodland, as Amanda Lawson took a group of visitors on a bird walk around the grounds.
I do usually one a season.
Oh, there it is. Okay, that's a great crested flycatcher.
In between bird sightings, Amanda tells me how she got started giving tours at the cemetery.
Actually, my grandparents are buried here, and they got me into birding when I was a little girl. And after Grandma and Grandpa passed away, actually during Grandpa's service, he went first. I just heard all kinds of birds, and I'm like, oh my gosh, this is awesome. And so I started bird watching here more, and this has become like my favorite place for urban birding in the entire area.
Amanda is a certified Ohio volunteer naturalist, And she shares her love of birding and the cemetery with other visitors.
It basically encourages people to volunteer in their communities doing environmental outreach. Oh, there's a white-breasted nuthatch I hear. Oh yeah, he's right on the end, working his way up.
Oh yeah,
little vertical branch there.
I didn't want to keep intruding on their bird watching, so I wandered around some of the 100,000 graves and monuments that are located in Woodland Cemetery, marking the graves of people like writer Irma Bombeck, African American poet Paul Dunbar, and of course, the famous Wright brothers Orville and Wilbur. For Why So Curious, I'm Renee Wild.
I'm not scared of dying. I don't really care.
You can see photographs of the famous boy and his dog monument on our website at WYSO.org. Why So Curious is sponsored by Proto Build Bar, proud supporter of Curious Minds.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac for the first week of late summer, the third week of the Blackberry Moon, and the week of the Perseid meteors. The Perseid meteors bring starfall to the northeastern portion of the sky on the nights of August 12th and 13th. And the arrival of those shooting stars marks high tide of the dog days. Rising out of winter's Taurus and Orion, the Perseids cut across Perseus and Andromeda, Cassiopeia and Pegasus, piercing the illusion of endless summer. Throughout the countryside, Queen Anne's lace, chicory, goldenrod, Joe Pieweed, sundrops, bull's thistles, black-eyed Susans, windstem, mullein, and ironweed are in full bloom along the roads. Soybeans are deep green and corn is lush. Now ragweed pollen fills the humid afternoons and wood nettle goes to seed in the bottomlands and hickory nuts and black walnuts drop into the undergrowth. Blackberries are ready to eat when the Perseid meteors fall. Golden and purple coneflowers and red, pink, and violet phlox rule the gardens. Orange and gold-flowered trumpet vines curl through trellises. Mums and stonecrop color the dooryards. In the mornings, cardinals and doves still sing briefly half an hour before dawn. Robins sometimes give long sing-song performances throughout the day, and blue jays still care for their young, whining and flitting through the bushes. But starlings and warblers become more restless. The number of fireflies dwindles. Hummingbirds, meadowlarks, Baltimore orioles, and purple martins start to disappear south. Their departure marks a quickening in the sun's descent to equinox. This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the second week of late summer. In the meantime, watch for the Perseid meteors after midnight on the 12th and 13th in the northeastern sky.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at WYSO.org.
That's it for this edition of WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world. I'm Jerry Kenney. Join us next Sunday morning at 10 o'clock. Up next on WYSO, it's Vic McCunis with the Book Nook.